Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Claire McDonnell, and in the early hours of Saturday the 29th of June, these are our main stories. A coroner has said MI5, Britain's security service, shouldn't be blamed for failing to prevent an Islamist attack in London which killed 8 people. Brazil and the EU have hailed a trade agreement for South America that took 20 years to hammer out. Progress at talks to save the Iran nuclear deal, but Tehran is asking for more. Also in this podcast...
Although it's fairly out there, there is the idea that you could possibly just have extant life there. You could have, it could be a place with simple life on its surface, somehow functioning in that super cold environment.
NASA's latest journey to search out Saturn. But first, 2 years ago, the security services were scrambled to an area of London packed full with people enjoying a Saturday night out. A van had been deliberately driven into pedestrians on London Bridge. 3 men who followed the Islamic State group then burst out and stabbed people in and around restaurants and bars. Police killed the attackers after 8 people died. One was British. The others came from Spain, France, Australia and Canada. The UK was on high alert at the time, and the families of some victims said they felt the attacks could have been prevented. But a coroner at the inquest into the deaths has said the security services should not be criticised for failing to stop the attack. Assistant Commissioner Neil Basu of the Metropolitan Police gave his reaction outside court.
The Chief Coroner has found that the pre-attack investigation was nonetheless thorough and rigorous. He was not persuaded that investigative opportunities were lost, which could realistically have saved the lives of those who so tragically died. Indeed, even after we carried out an intensive post-attack investigation, which was praised by the coroner, no evidence of long-term calculated planning could be found.
Our correspondent John Donison, who's been covering the inquest, has this report.
After 8 weeks of often powerful, graphic and moving testimony, the Chief Coroner, Judge Mark Lucroft QC, concluded all 8 of those who died were unlawfully killed. But his comments alongside his verdict have disappointed some of the victims' families. Judge Lucroft said there should be no criticism of MI5, even though they'd been investigating the ringleader Khurram Butt in the years leading up to the attack. Judge Lucroft said their investigation had been thorough and rigorous. But Philippe Pijard, the father of one of the victims, 26-year-old Frenchman Alexandre Pijard, disagreed.
The MI5 didn't stop that guy, despite all the signs. I know that in France we face really, really horrible attack. But I don't think a guy like Butt would be free.
Judge Lucroft criticised Khurram Butt's family for failing to report the attacker's extremist views to the authorities. He said a lack of barriers to prevent vehicle attacks on London Bridge was a factor in the deaths of Chrissy Archibald and Xavier Thomas, who were killed when they were hit by the attacker's van. Judge Lucroft said there were weaknesses in the system in assessing whether barriers were needed and then putting them in place. In the months before the attack, a security report commissioned by City of London Police concluded London Bridge was especially vulnerable, but no action was taken to install barriers. The attack happened less than 3 months after a similar assault on Westminster Bridge. Christine Delcroix, the fiancée of Xavier Thomas, who herself has not recovered from her injuries, blamed the authorities for a catalogue of staggering failings in the lead-up to the attack.
John Donison. 2 decades of talks between the European Union and the South American economic bloc Mercosur have finally yielded a free trade deal. The agreement with Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay and Uruguay creates a market for goods and services covering almost 800 million people. The EU said the deal would save European companies more than $4.5 billion in duties each year. The Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro described the deal as historic and one of the most important ever for his country. Phil Hogan is the EU's Agriculture Commissioner.
It's not every day you have a negotiation where you have a significant amount of barriers being reduced that is going to unleash an enormous amount of economic potential across our industrial sector, our services and our agricultural sectors. And as we said, the figures speak for themselves. It's the biggest deal done by the European Union with any particular trading partner.
The deal was struck as a wave of protectionism affects the global economy. Daniel Gallas reports from São Paulo.
Very complicated trade deal throughout these years. Not many people wanted this, not a lot of politicians, different governments. Very complicated to get everyone behind this. Basically, it means that European farmers who have managed to block out South American farmers with high tariffs would have to give up those high tariffs and compete more. The same thing happening with South American manufacturers who always wanted to have the market for themselves. So it took a long time to get everyone behind this, and a lot of people still are not behind this deal fully, but it has gone through. The big thing for Brazilian markets and for Argentinian markets, they already do a lot of their business with Europe, and they do a lot of business with amongst themselves because they have a customs union. But Brazil and Argentina, they desperately need to grow more, and they need more presence in global trade. Brazil is one of the world's most closed economies. It's very hard to do business down here because of the high level of tariffs. So the Brazilian ministry believes that this will boost the economy significantly in the coming years and could make actually this economy grow again. Brazil hasn't been doing very well. The same thing with Argentina. So they're hoping for this big boost that will be mainly driven by consumers in South America buying more products from Europe with cheaper access to those markets and selling more to those markets as well.
Daniel Gallas. Iran says that talks in Vienna aimed at saving the international nuclear deal have made progress, but not enough to meet Tehran's demands. The Iranians have threatened to increase their stockpile of enriched uranium if the European Union didn't protect them from sanctions imposed by President Trump after he abandoned the agreement a year ago. The United States Special Representative for Iran, Brian Hook, says pressure is yielding positive results.
Iran, for its 40-year history, thrives on terrorizing people, and it often works. And they escalate tensions until there is a relaxation of pressure. We don't believe in playing by those rules anymore. And this is why we have continued to deepen Iran's diplomatic isolation and to intensify the economic pressure.
China has also been attending the meeting. Fu Kong from the Chinese Foreign Ministry said that US sanctions against Tehran would not stop Beijing from importing Iranian oil.
We reject the unilateral imposition of sanctions. And for us, the energy security is important. And the importation of oil is important to the Chinese energy security and also to the livelihood of the people. We do not accept this so-called zero policy of the United States.
Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston is monitoring developments.
President Trump's sanctions on Iran really are very sweeping. They are having a devastating impact. And with each passing month, Iran's economic pain will grow. The Iranian leadership will see this as a potentially existential threat. So they're saying to the other countries involved in the nuclear agreement, those still committed to it, they're saying you must help mitigate these, ease the pain of these US sanctions. So today we saw in Vienna the British, the Germans, the French, the Russians, the Chinese all meeting with the Iranians to discuss the situation to see what could be done. The Europeans have put forward a complex barter-type trading system that might help the Iranians. But when the meeting broke up, the Iranians came out and, as you said there had been step forward, there had been progress, but simply not sufficient to meet Tehran's demands.
So what next? What are the Iranians likely to do?
Well, all the delegations in Vienna were actually fairly low level, and the Iranian delegation said it would have to now go and report back to its leadership in Tehran. But of course, we can expect the verdict there to be the same, that not enough has been done to satisfy Tehran. And that means that we might now see the Iranians starting to breach elements of that important nuclear agreement, an effort to put more pressure on the Europeans in that way. We may see, even within the next couple of days, the Iranians breach the agreed limit on the amount of enriched uranium that they're allowed to store. And that would be important, a significant moment, because up to now, the Iranians have kept to all the whole agreement. They haven't broken it, despite the fact that President Trump ripped it up more than a year ago.
Alan Johnston. NASA has said that its next search for signs of life will take it to Saturn's icy moon, Titan, which the American Space Agency describes as a richly organic world. An unmanned craft, Dragonfly, will be launched in 2026 and is due to arrive in 2034. It has rotary wings, similar to a helicopter, but it flies like a drone and will be able to land at various locations. To find out more, my colleague Dan Damon spoke to Robert Massey from the Royal Astronomical Society here in London.
Well, Titan is a really remarkable world. It's one of the largest moons in the solar system. Not the largest, but significantly bigger than our own moon. And it's in orbit around Saturn. Now, Saturn is a giant planet, famous for its rings, but it's got a big gravitational field. And so it holds onto a huge retinue of moons. And Titan is certainly, I think, the most interesting of all of them. Because unlike almost any other satellite in the solar system, it has a substantial atmosphere. Now, it's a long way from the sun, so it isn't an atmosphere like the one you have on Earth, but it's four times as dense. You know, this is a world with weather and remarkable chemistry.
But it won't be oxygen and nitrogen in that atmosphere. It'll be something else.
Well, there's lots of nitrogen, but it's much, much colder than it is on Earth. It's about 200 degrees below freezing, so a completely different environment. And it has a kind of weather like the Earth, which is, instead of being powered by water, it's powered by methane. So you have this very odd world where you have lakes of methane, you have methane rain and methane clouds. So an incredibly extraordinary system. And that's what's interested scientists, because these are carbon chemicals, hydrocarbon chemicals. And the idea is that although it's fairly out there is the idea that you could possibly just have extant life there. You could have, it could be a place with simple life on its surface, taking advantage of that chemistry and somehow functioning in that super cold environment. And even if it isn't there, it tells us something about the formation of life on our world as well.
Well, that's the point, I think, that I'd need more explanation on, that this can tell us what our Earth was like 4 billion years ago.
That's the idea, is that you're looking at an environment which is a bit like, say, the Earth in deep freeze. So it might have chemistry that was quite similar to the Earth early in its formation. But of course, the Earth was much closer to the sun. So it's very, very different. Processes are driven faster and so on. I mean, even the weather on Titan runs slowly, actually, and features change very slowly over time. Lakes fill and rains and so on. But, you know, nonetheless, the very fact that you have that dynamic world and you have a solid surface, and we sent a probe there with lots of UK involvement called Huygens back in 2005 and established that, you know, it was a place with river channels and oceans and lakes and weather, and that you could land things on the surface. And if you wanted to, we didn't then, but if you wanted to move them around is amazing, too. That's why it's such an interesting target for NASA now.
So tell us about Dragonfly. It'll be nuclear-powered. It's a kind of drone with those rotors.
Yeah, you couldn't do this in many places in the solar system, apart from actually the Earth, possibly Mars and places like Titan. Yes, it's going to fly around the Titanian atmosphere. The atmosphere is much denser than the Earth, so it makes that quite feasible. And, you know, it'll explore that way. Now, the pictures that we saw from the Huygens lander showed us that it is the kind of place you could do that, that you do have landscapes that look quite terrestrial, although at the same time being very alien. And the idea of the drone is that it can, you know, go from one place to another to extend its region, scan from, presumably take aerial pictures as well as doing surface sampling too. What I find amazing is this is going to be done from a distance of billions of kilometers across the solar system. There will be people there on Earth trying to drive this thing when even the signal will take, I guess, scratching my memory. I think the signal takes something like an hour to get there.
Robert Massey there from the Royal Astronomical Society. Still to come on this podcast.
And whether you're looking to lull yourself to sleep after a stressful day or just calm your frazzled nerves during the fifth set of a nail-biting epic on the courts, I invite you to put on your headband and get comfortable.
Can the former bad boy of tennis who ranted on court help you get a good night's sleep? The top appeals court in France has issued a final ruling that doctors can stop feeding a man who's been in a persistent vegetative state since a car crash nearly 11 years ago. The judges overturned an injunction by a court in Paris that ordered doctors to keep Vincent Lambert alive. The latest ruling means there can be no further appeal. Mr. Lambert's case has divided not only his family, but the nation. While his wife had long wanted to let him die, Mr. Lambert's parents tried all legal recourses to preserve his life. Our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders, is following the case.
Well, Vincent Lambert, if you want to give him his French pronunciation, was a psychiatric nurse. And when he was 32, he was involved in this huge car crash that sustained very severe head injuries. He's been in, well, initially in a coma, now a persistent vegetative state. So the doctors tried treatments for about 5 years. And in 2013, they realised he was making no progress. And they took a decision in consultation with his wife, Rachel, that treatment should be stopped, food withdrawn, and liquids also reduced. And eventually, of course, it would have led to his death. Now, it was 17 days into that withdrawal of treatment that his parents found out, Viviane and Pierre. They're both staunch Roman Catholics, and they vehemently opposed this course of action. They went to the court, got an injunction, and managed to have it stopped. And indeed, the treatment was restored after 31 days. So a substantial time. And I think that's why we're getting so much controversy and heat and division between the two sides of the family.
And yet we have this ruling today that doctors can stop feeding him. So what is the legal position, the new legal position?
This is the Cour de Cassation, which is the highest court in France, and it follows a whole swathe of legal rulings, initially by the Conseil d'État, which is the highest administrative court, and it ruled back in 2015 that there was absolutely no hope that Vincent Lambert could recover. He was just being kept alive artificially, and crucially, it said that keeping him alive met the test of the legal test of what's called unreasonable obstinacy in preserving life, and therefore the treatment should be withdrawn. The parents, through a long series of legal procedures, eventually took it to the European Court of Human Rights, which saying that his right to life, Article 2 of the European Convention, had been breached, and the court ruled no, they couldn't demonstrate that, and the procedure had been fully above board, taken to the very highest legal and medical levels.
So this ruling today, what happens next?
Well, in principle, the food could be withdrawn tonight. And that's what his nephew Francois believes. There was a really heated scene on the courtroom steps when one of the supporters of the parents accused him of actually signing a death warrant for another 1,700 similar cases. And he was very keen to point out that, no, this ruling only applies to Vincent. But the parents now say they'll charge the doctor with murder if he can persist in taking this food away. And it's even gone as far as the Pope, who's tweeted that life is God's gift from beginning to its natural end. Let us not give in to a throwaway culture.
Mike Sanders. A white supremacist who drove his car into a crowd of anti-racist protesters during a nationalist rally in the United States has been sentenced to life in prison. James Fields killed one person and injured more than two dozen others in the attack in Charlottesville in Virginia in 2017. The case stirred racial tensions across America. Barbara Plett-Usher reports.
James Fields carried out the attack during a rally of white nationalists protesting plans to remove the statue of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Using his car as a weapon, he killed one of the counter-protesters, Heather Heyer, and injured others. He avoided the death penalty by pleading guilty to 29 counts of hate crime and apologized for the hurt and loss he'd caused. Ms. Heyer's parents were present at the sentencing. They said they forgave Mr. Fields, but her mother Susan said his case sent a strong message that there were consequences for hate crimes. The rally was a critical moment in the rise of the far-right movement. Since then, public gatherings of white supremacists have drawn smaller crowds. President Trump was harshly criticized for his ambivalent response to the dispute between the neo-Nazis and the protesters, saying there were fine people on both sides.
Barbara Plett-Usher. He was arrested in 2015, and for more than 3 years, not even his wife knew anything about his fate. Then, this January, the Chinese lawyer Wang Qianjiang was jailed for state subversion in a trial held behind closed doors. His wife, Li Wenzhu, who campaigned for information about him, was distraught.
Wang Quanzhong has never committed a crime, but today they still charged him with a crime. I think this is because he wouldn't compromise with them. He wouldn't admit to any crime. So they finally charged him regardless and sentenced him to 4 years and 6 months. But I firmly refuse to recognize or accept this result.
Now, 5 months later, she and her six-year-old son have finally been allowed to see him, a visit that lasted just half an hour. Mr. Wang defended political activists and victims of land seizures. I heard more from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow.
Well, Wang Quanzhong was one of about 200 lawyers and activists picked up by the police in 2015. It was really an organised campaign to scare lawyers off, to close down civil society. It was Xi Jinping cracking down really on anybody who opposed his government. Now, over the years since then, all the other activists and lawyers have been charged, put into prison, released, but nothing was heard of Wang Quanzhong for 3 years. Nothing at all. His family didn't know whether he was dead or alive. His wife ran a number of public campaigns to try and find out what was going on about him. And then, finally, last December, he was put on trial. He was given a sentence in January, 4.5 years for state subversion. But still, his wife couldn't get to see him. So nobody had actually seen the man who was in prison.
And Li Wenxiu is his wife. And she's never given up, has she, in her campaign to find out what happened to him and get him out of jail. And today, 4 years on, she manages to see him. So what has she been saying?
Yes, extraordinary, actually, that first point you mentioned. In China, it's not easy for someone to campaign against the authorities. Li Wenxiu, she cut off her hair publicly. She walked all the way from Beijing to Tianjin, and a city nearby where her husband was being kept. She never gave up trying to raise public awareness about him, to try and get to see him. And finally, after 4 years, she finally got to see him today. Unfortunately, she was fearful beforehand. She wondered why the authorities weren't letting her see her husband. And after seeing him, she understands why. She's very concerned for his health, his mental health, his physical health. He's lost weight, he's got older. His skin, she said, was bright. Now it's black. He barely seemed to recognise them. He was staring away a lot of the time, looking down at notes as though he was reading from notes, insisting that he was being treated well in prison, telling her not to come again. And really, she was pretty distraught about what she saw.
So what happens now? She's finally got to see him, but does he stay there? Is this the end of it?
Well, he was given a 4.5 year sentence in January, but if you count back to the time he was detained, mid-2015, then he should be released sometime next year. But of course, the questions go on about what happened to him inside prison. There was always fear that he had been tortured. What his wife has seen today has certainly not allayed any of those fears. And really, Wang Quanzhong has become a symbol, really, of the treatment that you can face in a Chinese jail. Essentially, you disappear and there's nothing you can do if the authorities choose to keep you incommunicado, and there's nothing you can do if they decide to treat you badly.
Michael Bristow. We end with a tennis champion who wasn't known for keeping calm on court.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious! That ball was on the line. Chalk flew up. It was clearly in. How can you possibly call that out? How many are you going to miss? That he's walking over. Everyone knows it's in this whole stadium. And you call it out? Explain that to me, will you?
That's John McEnroe back in 1981 when he turned on an umpire at Wimbledon. After he called Ted James the pits of the world, one British journalist labelled McEnroe a super brat. In later years, the American capitalised on his notoriety. You Cannot Be Serious is the title of his autobiography. But now he wants to soothe you rather than shout at you by reading the rules of tennis for a mindfulness app.
Hello there. I'm John McEnroe. Some may call me the greatest tennis player of all time. Or maybe you've heard about me losing my cool with tennis authorities. I love the game of tennis. I'm just a stickler for rules and making sure they're applied accurately.
You're not expected to listen to the end. McEnroe hopes the recording, which lasts 25 minutes, will send you to sleep. But does it work? Dr. Nicola Barclay is a lecturer in sleep medicine at Oxford University. She's been listening.
I think really it's a distraction technique to stop you from thinking about the worries of the day, or to stop you from thinking about that attempt to try to get to sleep. We know that individuals with insomnia maybe go to bed really early to try to help themselves to get to sleep, but that is actually counterproductive and actually makes sleep much harder to find if we're trying so hard to achieve it. So really listening to something that we're not that interested in. I'm not saying that the article isn't interesting, but something that we don't have to think too much about.
And whether you're looking to lull yourself to sleep after a stressful day, or just calm your frazzled nerves during the fifth set of a nail-biting epic on the courts, I invite you to put on your headband and get comfortable.
There has been some research looking at the quality of sounds and different rhythms that may be relaxing or soothing. There's been some research looking at the reduction of anxiety with something called binaural beats. And binaural beats are sounds which may alter brainwave activity. And so that has been found to reduce anxiety. It looks promising that those sorts of rhythmic sounds delivered across the ears in a stereo signal could help to assist with the brain activity, reducing brain activity to help sleep onset. An individual may like the sound of rain or music.
Little one, put your toys away.
It's really down to personal preference, but different sounds such as what we call white noise, or things such as rain, or these monotonous sounds, the sound of a hairdryer, the sound of a fan, that can be really helpful. And you can find apps on phones that have white noise, and there are lots of different types of white noise, and they can be very good for helping sleep.
Dr. Nicola Barclay. And that is all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can. Just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Claire McDonnell, and until next time, goodbye.